Blog Talk Radio.
Thank you.
Gobble Gobble. This is Darlene Lewis, your host and show producer. Welcome to Hear No Evil here on Blog Talk Radio. Tonight, we are going to have a lot of people calling in, some rock stars, some regular folks, some people just shouting out their family members. So if you're calling in, please tell me your name and welcome to Blog Talk Radio. Good evening. Hello. I have a caller calling in from a 732 area code. State your name. Hello. You're on the air. I guess that caller is a little shy. Oh, hello. Can you hear me? I guess that person doesn't want to speak. Anyway, welcome to blogtalkradio.com/hearnoeve. I'm your show's host. And tonight we're going to talk about what's the most embarrassing thing that has ever happened to you. And also we will be speaking to the legendary producer, engineer, and DJ, Eli Tubo. Now, I don't know whether or not you guys know that sometimes behind the producers is really the engineer. The engineer is really the person that really makes the song tweak, makes it queued up, actually adds the funk and clarity to the finished product. And sometimes a lot of engineers go unnoticed. So later on in the show, Eli Tubo will be calling in to speak about his career and to also speak about what he's been up to in the music industry. Also, I'm going to read some poetry to you. And because today is Thanksgiving, I'm going to talk to you about health and fitness and wellness and some projects that I've been working on in regards to gardening and eating healthy, because this year I was diagnosed with diabetes. Now, don't feel sorry for me, because diabetes is curable. When you catch it early, you change your diet, you eat healthy foods, you can get rid of it. So don't cry for me, Argentina. But until Eli Tubo calls in, we're going to continue with some funky music. I'm going to slow it down a pace. Check it out. And when I say I'm slowing it down a pace, I'm slowing it down, meaning I'm going to slow down the type of music we listen. I'm going to take it to the past, bring it up to the future. Because a lot of times, a lot of people don't know the new stuff that's out is really a reflection of what has previously been played. And if you listen to the instrumentation and the engineering that's taking place now and the type of instruments that was played like in the 70s and 80s, you can almost differentiate the live from the fake. So I'm going to take you back. Oh, that took me back to the good old days. Well, I'm back, and I have a caller calling in. Hello.
Darlene?
Yes, would this be the illustrious Mr. Tuvo?
Oh, I'm illustrious. Okay, I can take that.
Welcome, Eli Tuvo, to Hear No Evil here at blogtalkradio.com. How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm really good. How about you? As a matter of fact, long time no see. I mean, we used to hang out.
I know.
A
it's
long
been
time
a month.
Ago. I mean, this is not new for us, you know.
This is not new for you?
Not for us. I mean, back in Donald D days and B-Fats, and you were always there in the mix.
Writing yeah, but I wasn't doing no
like
mixing.
Nah,
you
were
doing the mixing.
I mean, you was doing your thing. You was in, as a matter of fact, I got to be careful because your stuff, you're filming stuff, and it's popping up 10, 15 years later, so I got to be careful.
Actually, I don't know. I'm still looking and digging in the crates and seeing if I have anything of you. But believe me, I probably do. But I have some great memories, so that's all good. But Eli, listen, tell your we have a lot of people calling in. You have a lot of fans. People have been calling in and wondering where you're at. So now 9 times out of 10, people are going to be jumping in because the lines are open. I see people calling from Albany, people calling from Jersey. I don't know, this other area code, 908. I guess that's, I don't know, I think that's Jersey also. But anyway, I want to thank you for calling in. Now, a lot of people aren't aware of your history. I did my research, of course, when I first met you. But a lot of people don't know that you used to be a DJ.
Absolutely, yeah. As a matter of fact, I started off.
You go back, like you go back way, I'm talking about when, like your teenage years, like when you weren't even supposed to be able to get in the club.
Yeah, it was probably about two days after I was legal to get into a club. But when I started DJing, I was actually in Queens College, to tell you the truth. And I met a guy named Jet Proctor, who was a student there. And Jed eventually ended up opening up a club called the Renaissance, and that club
in Queens.
That was the club where Tom Brown's Funkin' for Jamaica. He was talking about, you know, we went down to the Renaissance the other night, and you know, I seen Jed. So that was the club that everybody would come down to, like Crown Heights Affair and Lucy Martin from Chic and Russell Simmons, and I mean, it was like the place to be. And I was the DJ there. And
now, how did you wind up being a DJ there?
Actually, it's a funny story. Jet had first managed a club called La Casablanca. It was the first club up in Queens, up on 215th Street and Jamaica Avenue. And it was the first large black club of its kind that could hire groups like the Tramps and Chic and things like that, and we could see live performances. And they were having a hustle contest back then. And the girl that I was dancing with, Jet, the owner, really thought she was cute. So one day, she went to Queens College, I went to Queens, and Jet was at Queens. So one day he said, you know, we're remodeling the club, you want to come by and see it? So I just happened to be invited because he really wanted to hang out with her. And so he brought us into the club. We had our eyes closed, and then, you know, he turned on the music, turned on the lights. It was like an afternoon, like maybe 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And he turned on everything, and then he started dancing with her. So I walked up to the booth to keep the music going, and that's actually how I started DJing. I would go down to that club every Tuesday after school, and I would just, you know, leave with Jet. I would DJ all afternoon, and then eventually the club would open, and then before you know it, I was DJing at 12 o'clock at night, and that's kind of how it got started.
So was this like in the 70s or 80s?
This was like the edge of, I don't want to date myself that much, but yeah, it was kind of like the like very early 80s.
Okay.
Either the edge of 70s, 80s. You know,
right, because you said the hustle. I mean, I was doing a hustle like in 74, 75.
Yeah, I mean, and it was the beginning of the hustle. And the funny thing is that I've been around long enough to see things come back. So everybody is, there was a there was a dance called a bus stop where everybody would get in line and start
right,
dancing together
right.
and then see things
but
come back again.
But that's Electric Slide now.
I'm like, Electric Slide? I'm like, man, this ain't, what is this?
Exactly, that's the bus stop. And remember they had a song called the bus stop?
That's right. South Soul Records had a song called the bus stop. That was a big thing. And we were there,
Okay,
doing all that
moving up from the Renaissance, is that how you got into engineering and stuff like that?
Well, I think that's important is that back then it was WBLS Radio, which was like the hub. It was WWRL and WBLS Radio. That was mm-hmm. really, really important in terms of the history of urban music, especially hip-hop. And a lot of people mm-hmm. don't know that, but there's a transition between R&B and hip-hop that people tend to forget. And during that time, we used to listen to the radio and hear everything that we wanted. And back then, they had these master mixes that were on the radio, Chet Pettibone and John Morales and things like that. And mm-hmm. as a black DJ, I wanted to be, on WBLS. So I would do pause mixtapes and stuff like that. And I actually started to learn how to edit tapes. And there was a guy named John Morales and Sergio Mundibay. They were like the resident master mixers at WBLS. And
mm-hmm.
at that time, they were mixing a lot of people's records in the studio. And they got so busy that they couldn't do their half-hour dance mix party. And so they asked the DJ, they put out a request for all the DJs in New York City to submit their tapes. And I submitted my tapes, and they picked six DJs out of the DJs. And mine was one of the six, and that's how I got to be on BLS. But before then, we had the DJs had really gotten together. We had formed a record pool, and there's a whole lot of history that has to do with DJing and the music industry and how DJs were important in terms of breaking records and things. You remember
mm-hmm.
stuff like that. The DJs were important in terms of breaking records and starting record pools and Disco Den record pools, which was the first R&B black Hispanic pool where DJs got real credibility in terms of breaking records and stuff like that. So I was part of that whole history. And in the pool, you had Herb Powers, who became a
right.
And remember Kevin Woodley, who became A&R for
Atlantic, I think.
Exactly.
Columbia or Atlantic, one of them.
Exactly. And all of these guys were like DJs back then. And then out of those pools, they all broke off into different parts of the music and this business. So DJing was basically a stepping stone to get you into the music business at that time, for those that really took it seriously.
Wow. So now you become an engineer. Where were you engineering?
It's so funny because a lot of things were connected. The first time I went into a recording studio, there was a guy named Vin Zarelli, or they called him Vinzy of Lady, and he was doing a record with a guy named Ron Mason. And he was a roller skater at that time. We used to go down to Brooklyn to Empire Roller Rink, and we used to
mm-hmm.
skate. So at the time, because of being a hot DJ and getting my mixes on WBLS, a lot of people wanted me to start mixing their records. So I went into the studio with him, and that song was Bounce Rock Skate Roll. And I went in and I mixed, that record and put the break in and did all kinds of stuff like that. But that didn't come out as Vinzy. That came out as Vaughn Mason. Vaughn Mason decided to be the artist. So that was the mm-hmm. first record that I actually went to the studio with and started really working. From there, I was DJing at the same time, and I was going to Power Play Studios. And
Power Play, Patrick Adams.
That's right. Tony Arfi was the owner of Power Play, and I think within a month's time I had been there with four different clients
mm-hmm.
that wanted me to mix their records. And Tony was like, wow, you look like you got a client base, you want to be an engineer. And I really did want to be an engineer, and I couldn't afford the $6,000 at the time to go to IAR to be a recording engineer.
IAR?
Yeah.
What is that?
They have that commercial. You want to be a recording engineer? Institute of Audio Research, that's what it was.
Oh.
And that's how you have to learn to be an engineer. And, you have to pay $6,000. But Tony Arfi saw me, a young black guy that was there, and I had come in with about four different groups. So he said, you want to be an engineer. So I was DJing at the same time, and I was engineering. And at that time, I was doing it for free. I was just learning. And that's where I met Patrick Adams, because he was my mentor. And I was able to sit underneath him and learn a lot of stuff.
Now,
and
what
I,
year was that
that you met Patrick Adams? You know, that was like 80s. And you know, Patrick Adams is like, he actually is a genius. He actually is an icon. He did the Black Ivy records. He did all of the disco stuff. And later on, he did Eric B. and Rakim, you know, Paid in Full, because he's the one that's responsible for me being on that album. But it just goes to show, when I was saying the connection between R&B and hip-hop, that the people that were initially creating the sounds of hip-hop were experts in R&B. And when I was doing my records, I was trying to get my records to sound as good as the R&B records, which is why a lot of the hip-hop records that were done in the golden age really sound really good, because we were really trying to make the best records possible. But I met Patrick at Power Play Studios, and I started off as, you know, like assisting him, and but I knew how to edit tape really good from doing the WBLS thing, so I was cutting tape really good, and it made me quick to get my own clients. And at
now,
that
when
time,
you say cutting tape, were you splicing? Because you know, as a filmmaker, when I hear cutting tape, I'm thinking of splicing the tape and then putting, you know. So, like when you say cutting tape, like how what was the process like? Because it's a different process now. A lot of people don't understand that.
Well, actually, you're right. Back then, they had They had the what they call the half-inch reel, and actually the two-inch reels. The tape looked like actually half-inch, and the beat, the machines, would, the tape would go by at 30 inches per second. And so the beat was really big. And at the time when I was doing the BLS mixes, I had bought this little quarter-inch tape machine, and I was cutting the tape, and the beat was really small.
Mm-hmm.
And you actually had a splicing block, and you would actually cut the actual tape, and then you would take out the piece that you didn't want, and then you would put the two pieces back together. It was called editing. It was called splicing. So if if you wanted something to go bam, 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 you had to record those horn hits three times, and then you would have to find the beginning of the horn hit and cut it there, mark it, cut it there with a grease pencil, and then take a piece of tape and stick it together. And then as the tape run across the head, it would go bam, then bam, and you have to have timing and things like that. But when I got to Power Play, the machines were going so fast compared to what I was used to that I became a real excellent editor and tape splicer.
Wow.
Yeah.
This is amazing, because people don't understand, Eli, the work that went into making audio sound a certain way. Like people nowadays, you know, with this digital, they don't understand that it was not this easy.
Let me put it this way. You're right in the sense that it was a lot of work. But what I have found is that it takes a lot of work to really do it well, whether it's digital or whether it's analog. See, a lot of people automatically assume because it was digital, it would be easy. But if you really, if you listen to a lot of the digital stuff, a lot of it sounds like crap.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of it, some of it sounds good. So when you listen to, say, an Alicia Keys album and you listen to somebody else's album, if you don't do the homework to understand digital audio, there's a lot of mistakes that are being made. And the thing that I find that's really important, and, you know, darling, you and I have been around for a while.
Mm-hmm.
When you become successful at what you do, there's always the chance that you could become very comfortable and you stop learning. And mm-hmm. so I've seen this pattern in the music business, whether it be live drums, recording live drums, doing live strings and stuff like that, and then all of a sudden a drum machine comes out. And then there are those people that jump on the drum machine and they start programming with the SP-1200 and things like that. And there are all those people that stand in the back that says, that drum machine won't have the human feel. That string, that synthesizer won't have the real string sound. They sit there and they criticize it, and what they're really doing is they're afraid of change. And so their fear of change just causes them to, and it could be jazz musicians that say they don't like R&B, or it could be gospel singers that call R&B devil's music or what happened. And then all of a sudden, years later, you hear Kirk Franklin doing the same tracks over and now all of a sudden it's anointed. The thing is that there's a resistance to change that has to be recognizable, so that when you stop learning and you stop putting yourself out there to learn, you get stale.
Wow.
You see, so now with
digital,
so you went
with the change. So you actually just accepted the change in style and mastered the change.
Yeah, I'm still learning stuff, because with the new technology that's coming out so fast, I mean, right now I'm in the textbooks and stuff like that in terms of certain programs and things like that. Because a lot of the music that we hear, the flow of it and the sound of it has a lot to do with the equipment, the engineers, the sound. Mm-hmm. So there's a drum machine like an SP-1200, and everybody uses that, and then that becomes the sound. If it's an emulator, that becomes the sound. So you have to learn the technology to stay current. And whether it's what is it, auto tune or whatever that new thing is, that's what gravitates when a creative person gets on it and makes that sound. So
let me ask you a question. So you're working in it, because I want to take the chronological journey, because I don't want to go off base. You start out as a DJ, then you start mixing at the WBLS. Now, this was, when you said you was mixing at WBLS, was this R&B stuff you were mixing? Or disco? It wasn't hip-hop, right?
Actually, you raise a very, very good point. You raise a very, very good point. We have to remember that when I started doing the WBLS mixes, that was before Kiss came out. So BLS was the sole thing. That was when Frankie Crocker, matter of fact,
exactly.
Frankie Crocker had gone away to jail or something like that around that time, and he was gone. And you know what that was about. But I never knew
what happened with him.
Okay, but anyway, because we could really go off. But at that time, hip-hop was just starting to come out in terms of records. And Sugar Hill Gang had proven to the music industry that hip-hop was financially feasible, that it made sense. But the reaction to hip-hop from the established community, music community, was negative. So WBLS was saying, we don't want you playing hip-hop. Okay? And the only time that hip-hop was played, I think Mr. Magic had a show at midnight, but hip-hop was not being played during the daytime on WBLS.
Mm.
So the things that make this story relevant is that I loved hip-hop when I heard it. And as a DJ playing in the clubs like Renaissance, we were playing R&B and hip-hop mixed together. Okay? Now, the thing with the clubs was that the clubs didn't like hip-hop, because the people that were into hip-hop were into sneakers, and they weren't into buying suits and stuff like that. So the clubs were saying, we don't want hip-hop in there either.
Okay, Eli, I hate to interrupt, but I have these lines. I have callers calling in from all across America. Thank you guys for calling in. I am on the air with the illustrious genius, Eli Tubo. I'm going to let people jump in right now, because they keep getting disconnected and calling back, and I don't want them to incur all of these long-distance charges. So if you guys have questions that you want to ask him briefly, say who you are, where you're calling from, blah, blah, blah. You're on the air. Caller from 518 area code. You go first.
Yes, this is GQ from Albany. How you doing, Eli?
Hey, how you feel, man? It's a pleasure talking to you.
I was listening to what you were saying about the technology and stuff. My question is, as far as the industry is concerned and the way the technology has advanced so much and it's constantly changing, how do you think it's either helping or hindering the industry today as compared to where it's – and I say that because it's like I hate to use this analogy, but it's like when crack came out, it made everybody a hustler. So now that the digital came out, it made everybody a DJ. How do you feel that impact has affected the industry and the music as far as making sales for records and quality music?
I think that's a great question. It's a great question, but it's a very big question. I think the first thing is that we have to look at the music industry in terms of what it was and what it is right now.
Right.
And the equipment that you're asking about is responsible for the change in the music industry, as you say. We went back in the day, there was an actual music industry structure, and those structures were in place. You had the record labels that had the recording budgets, and you had the distributors, you had the mom-and-pop stores, you had the radio stations, you had the DJs, the clubs, and all of these people had a place in which they were working together. And so if you had an artist, you knew, let's just say you didn't have money, you can go to a record company, they would give you a recording budget, and that's how you were able to record your music. With the record companies, you had to go through a mastering. So there was a control, a quality control that the music industry had back in the day. When digital started coming out, people started bypassing a lot of these quality controls like A&Rs, which is actually good. But the thing that was happening at the same time was that as a result of that, especially people in the urban community, we tried to make music with the least financial cost because that's
right.
what we have to do. So
right.
if you had to go to studio and pay $150 an hour, but then you can buy ADATs and you can record at your house, then what are you going to do? You're going to take that recording budget, you're going to go to your house, and you're going to build a little project studio. So once they built the project studios, they started putting a lot of the other studios out of business. And
right.
You see what I'm saying? So now what happens is that we're looking at a industry now that has no structure and has no foundation.
Ooh.
And so to say what you were saying, it's like a hustle.
Right.
Everybody's hustling in which
right.
there's no way for the average person that doesn't have a history to actually make those big gains like they did back in the day.
Right.
Now, I want to interrupt you for a second. We have another caller calling from a 619 area code. You're on the air. Welcome. Hello.
Hello. I'm just listening to the show by phone. I don't have anything to contribute.
Oh, well, thank you for listening in.
Happy Thanksgiving.
I'm sorry for interrupting.
Where's 619? Where's 619?
San Diego.
San Diego. Oh, cool.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, we had a caller calling in from a 908 area code. You guys, we're going to take a brief pause for the calls, and we'll be right back.
Tell me the truth. Mama just hung her head and said, son, Papa was a rolling stone. Wherever he laid his hat was his home. Papa never was a day in his life.
And Mama, some bad talk going around town saying that Papa had 3 outside children and another wife. And that ain't right.
Heard some talk about Papa doing some storefront preaching. Talking about saving souls and all the time leeching.
Welcome back to Hear No Evil. This segment is brought to you by Make It Real Productions, who presents a not-always-funny comedy about marriage, community, therapy, history, true love, romance, and, well, life. Written and directed by Gary Gabriel. And you can get tickets with your $15 by calling 917-250-2699. The Black Box, 308 West 133rd Street between St. Nicholas and 8th Avenue on the second floor, 8 p.m., November 29th, 30th, December 1st, December 6th, December 7th, and December 8th. You can see a very dangerous game. Well, we're here now with Eli Tubal. So now, Eli.
Yeah.
So you taking it from the DJ. I'm going in chronological order, okay? You meet
right.
a guy named Jet because you're dancing with a girl that he wants to get with.
So,
he
yeah,
invites
okay.
you. You wind up working at the Renaissance.
Right.
Then you go. Of course, you go into all the clubs. I'm quite sure you go into all the clubs to see what's being listened to. Now, people like Russell Simmons and all of these different people probably coming in trying to get you to, you know, break records or whatever. Because I know back in the day, Russell was out there, you know, pushing Curtis Blow and all his other artists that he was with, right?
Actually, tell you the truth, and I think this is important. When Russell was coming down to the club, Russell was not getting any respect.
Right.
Russell was getting no respect, whatever.
Right.
When he brought Curtis Blow down, and here's the funny thing, I mean, the club owner was telling me don't play rap stuff.
Mm.
And so what happened was I put the instrumental side on and I was watching it because I knew how to mix. And that's how, you know, Russell and I became friends. And I actually went on tour with Curtis Blow as a road manager working for Russell back then. And when Russell would go into the studio, he had Orange Crush Band, which was actually Allison Williams, and
right.
Russell was the voice. I mean, Russell was the voice, the Munchkin voice, or, you know, Baby, I'm Sorry. We were all working together. Nobody was really big back then. But Russell, matter of fact, a lot of times Russell won't acknowledge the club owners because when he was going to them and asking them to help him invest in Russ Productions, none of them would give him any play whatsoever.
Mm.
Yeah, hip hop was not accepted at
That's
a
right.
lot of different levels. It really wasn't.
Okay, so do you remember the first hip hop song you ever played on the radio or in the club?
Actually, yeah. The first time that I got on BLS, I was I think that was 1988, and that was a really big year for me because I had been mixing in the studios, and that was the time that Run DMC's first album came out. So it was Sucker MC and what is it? It's Like That, and That's the Way It Is. So Russell had called me in, and I mixed Sucker MC. So when I did the BLS mix, BLS was saying no rap music, but because my mixes were so hot, I mixed in Sucker MC and I mixed in Chaka Khan and Mary J. Girls all in the same mix. Actually, that happened to be online. And BLS played that mix.
So you had to, like, cover it up. Callers, if you're going to be on the radio with us live, you're going to have to either step away from the speakers or whatever you're doing because we're getting your feedback. We appreciate that. Thank you. You know, this is the new technology, so there's certain things you can't do when you're on the digital divine. Okay, so back to you, Eli. So basically you had to basically muffle the hip-hop with the R&B.
Well, I would say that John Morales and Sergio Munzai were very forward-thinking. And when they heard the mix was so hot because I was doing what the other disco mixes were doing, but I was doing with R&B and hip-hop. And so when they put that mix on at 12 o'clock in the afternoon, that was the first time that hip-hop was played on WBLS in the afternoon. That was my first mix.
Right.
That was my first radio mix on WBLS. It had Run DMC, and it also had Curtis Blow in the mix with the OJs and some other dance stuff. And I'm really proud of that because I feel that I was responsible for hip-hop being moved forward in radio as well.
So now, because a lot of people credit Red Alert as being the first DJ to put hip-hop on the radio, commercial radio.
Let's be let's be clear, okay? And I have a lot of respect for hip-hop. Matter of fact, we worked together because I recorded his first album, okay? There were certain people that were on the radio before me that were radio disc jockeys, like Mr. Magic and Red Alert. Mr. Magic, you know, was on the air before I was with his he had a radio show that was at midnight every time, and Red Alert had his radio show. I was not a radio DJ. I was a guest DJ that was coming in and doing a half-hour lunch mix dance party. But before, this was before KISS, because when Frankie Crocker came back to BLS, they got rid of all of the DJs. And KISS came to me and said, we like what you're doing. You want to be like a Red Alert and be a radio DJ. But I decided that I wanted to go the route of engineering and producing. I didn't want to go the route of radio DJing. So KISS hadn't started yet with their hip-hop format. Okay. So yeah, Red Alert, matter of fact, Red Alert is the one who really opened up the sound of hip-hop and reggae. Because reggae wasn't being played in New York, but in the mainstream, and Red Alert deserves props for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because go ahead.
Okay, so wait. All right, so you're saying that Red Alert was the first DJ to promote hip hop on KISS?
I know that KISS was doing hip hop before BLS was doing hip hop, for sure.
Okay.
Because I remember Barry Mayo and them back then, they decided they were going to go in the direction of hip-hop because hip-hop records were so hot in the clubs because they used to go down to the clubs and see what was playing, and they knew what was happening in the streets.
Mm-hmm.
So
were you getting your records from Downstairs Records like everybody? Do you remember Downstairs Records?
I remember Downstairs Records. Are you kidding me? If you couldn't be a DJ in New York without doing Downstairs Records, you know. And that's before we had the pool. But even then, Downstairs Records became the place that you can get those overseas.
The break beat.
You could get, what was it? You could get those international hits, those plates and stuff like that. Yeah, if you was a DJ in New York, you had to go to Downstairs Records.
Right, because I used to go to Downstairs Records with this guy named Michael B. Actually, his name is Michael Bullock. And he was the music director for the group Double Exposure. You know, they made 10%.
Right.
But he was a DJ. Now, this guy is funny because he and Patrick Adams were cool and Richie Weeks from Weeks and Company. And that's how I got, and this was, I'm talking 81, 82.
No,
I was a lyricist.
Right. That's right.
And these guys were in Power Play, and he got Patrick Adams to engineer my song, A-Train, and he got Richie Weeks from Weeks & Company to play on. And that same night, Richie Weeks wound up getting a heart attack because they were working so hard.
That's right. But you know what? And you know you're right because all those names you mentioned, that's why I told you, darling, you've been in the circle for a long time. A lot. You need to do a show on yourself because Patrick Adams, Greg Carmichael, and all those guys, here's the thing that's really important. When the music industry was coming out, music was the means in which urban people were moving from poverty into the working class, into the middle class. And that's very important to understand, especially when that may not be a way that we can do it now. But back then, those brothers like Patrick Adams and Greg Carmichael and Richie Weeks, they were the ones that were analyzing the music business and figuring out, you know what, we can have independent labels. You know what, we can have distribution deals ourselves. And they were teaching us how to be functional in the music business. So there was a mentorship that was going on so that when I went into the studio with Patrick Adams, I already knew what he had done. I had been dancing to his records and buying his records, and I was in awe being in the same studio with him, and he was like the coolest, the humblest guy. And that's why when the Eric B. and Rakim album came out, Patrick had burned himself out trying to finish that album, and it had to be turned in the next day. And he came to me and said, hey, man, we got these songs to finish. Can you finish up these last three songs? And that night, it was Eric Wilde, myself, and we were in the studio, and we worked on Pain in Full, Move the Crowd, and one other song, and finished those all three songs in one night. But that's another story.
Wow,
but,
you did all three songs in one night?
That's right. Matter of fact, Just to show you how brilliant Rakim was, he did Thinking of a Master Plan, but they number split. So he did that in one take.
Wow.
One take. He wrote it that night.
Wow. Can you imagine? You're sitting in, because at the time they were on 4th and Broadway, right?
Matter of fact, they had Eric B. for President was the only track that was out. They was on 4th and Broadway, right?
Because I still have something. I don't know what it was. It was a party or something, and we went to something Russell did at the Garden, and me with pictures of me, him, and Peaches, and he was promoting this. This was like 85.
That's
and,
right.
And that's when he had like the little, the Gumby haircut and the jewelry. But he was a cool dude.
They was rolling with Rush. They was rolling with Rush. Matter of fact, he was one of the coolest. That's probably one of the most meaningful recording experiences that I've had in my career.
And he was a spiritual guy, too. And you know what? I blew because he was really trying to get with me, and I just was not into. Well, I was seeing someone. Anyway, that was a whole other story. But anyway, well, my thing is like, that he was so spiritual. Like, we had a connection.
We need to do a show on you, Darlene. That's the real show. We're going to flip this, and I'm going to talk
to you. No,
no, seriously.
Like I said, I had opportunities to be with so many people that became so famous.
Hearts,
I'm like,
all those broken hearts that was laying down on the street as you walked by and everything. You were doing your thing
back
then.
I wasn't paying that no attention. I was trying to be... I was trying for guys to understand that I wanted to be in the studio like the guys, but they weren't thinking. Maybe it was the way I was dressed. Maybe if I would have been wearing, like, dressing like Missy Elliott, because you see how she just got on, and I'm like, I was doing this before Missy.
Don't try to overthink it. You was walking in there thinking that you was, I'm a singer, I'm a writer, I'm a this and that. And the guys was like, they were trying to hear it.
They wasn't trying to hear. Donald D was the only one that said, listen, if you really want to learn this, I'll show you how to work the boards. You know, I conned my cousin Eric to move here from Cali. I was like, listen, we could do this music industry. You just got to get the equipment, and I'll make the connections. Because at the time, I didn't realize these people were going to be major. They were just regular studio. None of us did.
Matter of fact, when you're working on... when you're working with Salt and Pepper, when you're working with some people before they get big, and that's the interesting thing about being a recording engineer and being a producer and being an artist. Okay, I'm not an artist per se.
A DJ is an artist. I don't care what anyone says.
I stand corrected. You are right. But I want to put it this way, okay? And you've been in the studio with me a couple of times, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Back in the day.
Didn't you do the Malira stuff?
That's right. Yeah, that was the Malira stuff. That's when you was hanging with Donald. That's right. That was Apollo. That's when I was the main engineer at Apollo Studios for that record label. But
Motown, Apollo, something like that.
Yeah, the Apollo Records.
They had a live studio in there too.
No question. But here's the thing that I really want to say that's really important. Most of the time when we think of the music industry, it's always from the perspective of the artist. Okay, and the artist is like the tip of the iceberg, and the main part of the iceberg is below the water. Mm. And a lot of people don't hear the perspective of the other players. So let's just say you and I, and this has happened, where you and I have been in the studio at the same time. If you're working with Donald, we're working with Donald D, okay? You come in and you sit there and you're the writer. So you and Donald are working on the song. And I'm the engineer. I'm sitting in the engineering seat, okay? Now, let's just say you and Donald are working on the song and y'all reach a place where you can't figure something out. If I make a contribution and y'all say, yeah, that's a good idea, I don't get the credit as far as being a writer because I'm sitting in the engineering chair. You, however, because you came in the room as a writer, y'all would actually get that collaboration together. Because if I say... You know what? It should be Run with the Wind, not Jump with the Wind, and that makes it a hit. Very few people say, you know what? That's it. Give them part of the ridership. So what's happening is that the engineer is almost like an invisible ghost where people don't really want to give him the credit that's due. You understand what I'm saying?
Wow, because you contributed to so much. But you did get the engineering credit, but a lot of people don't know that you may have written some, or you when the producers leave, you're the one that's really left with the product, just fixing it up and getting it the right way, and may have added some extra musical thing in there to make it sound a little juicier, and don't even get the credit for it.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's true, too. And don't get me wrong, I've been very blessed because, I mean, I walk into the roughest studios, and everybody's got the screw face on, and then once somebody says, yo, Eli, turn up the bass, let's be, keep on rocking from Rakim, and then all of a sudden I get a tremendous amount of respect. Mm-hmm. And that's one thing that I could say about people in hip-hop, that they did respect what I did, and they always gave me respect. But what I am saying is that the engineer's job is to get into your head. You have a creative idea. My job is not to produce your idea solely as an engineer. My job is to get into your reality and technically figure out how to give you what you want so that you can hear it outside of yourself, and also to do it within budget and do it, you know, in a superior way. So the engineering is much more, and which leads to, why are there no awards for engineers? None, because what happens is most people don't want to say, I got stuck, or I didn't know, or this guy was the one that took me to the next level. For some reason, they just want to pretend like it just happened, you know? And
well, maybe
it's
your petition for that. So, you know, it's not hard for me to just start a petition and say, listen, Grammys and American Music Awards, what about the engineering award?
Yeah, especially with hip-hop because, I've been very fortunate with hip-hop, and most of the times when I run to somebody, they nod with me because they look at me like, yeah, my brother, if it wasn't for you, I wouldn't be here. So I haven't had any problems whatsoever. But you do know the artist sometimes before they're big. So you're in a creative space where you're trying to make something happen, and you're putting all these things into place. You're putting all these things in the pot, and that's a beautiful space to be in.
Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
The self-destruction, because I was also involved with trying to come. I did some art. We were supposed to be doing a book and I had contracted an artist to do some pointillism of all the artists that actually did the self-destruction, and we were trying to come up with this committee, this anti-violence thing, which, you know, after a week or so, the committee just dissolved, but Nelson George was trying to do something with it. But it was because of that album that I really, really acknowledged you more. Do you think that's the album that did it for you, like the self-destruction?
I think the album that did it for me, and I think there was a couple of albums that did it for me, but being that you brought up self-destruction, and this is your show, I'm going to give you the inside scoop on self-destruction, okay? okay, because I know you like listening to your show. This is like what was happening underneath everything.
No, I like the fact, it just dawned on me that you engineered that whole creation. That is like, that's like going to go down in history. Do you not understand the importance of that album?
I do understand that album's importance in terms of it was the first album in which artists from different labels came together and said, you know what, we got to do something about this violence.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, the record labels were saying if you signed to this label, they had exclusive rights or whatever. And the artist said, no, we want to make this record together, and we want to do this thing, okay? The self-destruction that I did, first, there was a self-destruction that came out in which KRS had done it, was done with Boogie Down Productions. But KRS was so hot at the time, and he couldn't get it finished by January 16th. So they had D-Nice, who was part of Boogie Down Productions, to come to the studio. So you had the 16-year-old kid that comes into the studio that hadn't produced anything. So it was just D-Nice and I in the studio at the same time. And D-Nice had the James Brown loop and stuff like that. And between the two of us, we kind of worked together and restructured it, and that was like the B side, which actually became the A side. So if you listen to Self-Destruction, on one side, you have the version that had the old beat on it, and then on the new side, you have the production and stuff that Dean Ice and I put together with the additional vocals and stuff like that, too. And that record was a very, very important record in the sense that I'm glad you brought this up, darling, because this is very important. If music is not put within a social context, it has no meaning. Okay? And too many times people look at intense emotions or they look at the pain of our people and they use it as entertainment. They're very amazed at the fact that, you know, maybe somebody's singing and they're with pain and stuff like that. But if you don't understand the social context, the music has no legs. So when Marvin Gaye is singing What's Going On, or when Curtis Mayfield is singing Runaway Child Going Wild, or when Rakim is saying Thinking of a Master Plan, a number sweat inside my hand, you know, reaching to my pocket on my money spent, that's somebody who's broke, who's dealing with a social condition in which the subculture is dealing with the dominant culture's pressure between the two. And that type of pressure is expressed whether it's Martin Luther King, whether it's Malcolm X, whether it's Rakim, whether it's Public Enemy. Those things are what give the music its reality. So in order to appreciate Self-Destruction, we have to understand the history of what was going on in our neighborhoods at the time, where we were compelled to say, we got to do something, or a lot of people were saying, we have to do something to compensate for the fact that there was black-on-black crime. You see?
Wow. Like, I've never even thought about taking music from a sociological point of view. But you're right, because when you think about a song like Melly Mel, The Message.
Exactly.
You know, yeah, you're right. You're 100% right. Are there any callers out there that want to jump in and ask Eli or talk to Eli about something? Callers. Hello. Hello. Okay.
But darling, here's also something else that's really important. When you're dealing with it from the sociology of it, hip hop always gives the impression that it was broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the corner like they just don't care, and that's part of hip hop too. But the part that's not told is, what about the people that were in the working class and middle class blacks that was there? Because I had to go into recording studios and people had to deal with record labels, and a lot of them were in colleges and stuff like that. So hip hop didn't move where it did by just the rappers. There was a whole culture of intelligent, hardworking, middle class people that were in Jamaica, St. Albans, Hollis, Brooklyn, Bed-Stuy, stuff like that. So it wasn't all just criminality and there were some real good people that were involved that weren't just black, too. Because Roddy Way and Brian Chin, they were Asian. Roddy Way was the Asian engineer for the Run DMC album. Brian Chin was the one that was engineering Salt and Pepper stuff. So hip-hop was a real universal thing that was happening back then with a lot of different people.
But the media wants you to think that these kids are just coming from, like, starvation. I think because, you know, in the Bronx, those are the guys that really got a lot of the notoriety. But they weren't the first. I mean, they're getting the notoriety, but they weren't, like, the first people. Like, because I remember growing up, going, like, down the hill on 164th and Anderson. Okay, and I would see Pete DJ Jones getting his records and stuff together. I remember Eddie Chiba in the club. I couldn't get in the club because I was too young, but I remember sneaking in 371 Club and seeing DJ Hollywood. I was 15. I'm talking 1975.
A lot of people
want to argue with me when I talk about, like, hip-hop, and I'm like, listen, let me tell you, there were some DJs that was rapping. Eddie Chiba was like, Chiba, Chiba. Do you understand
okay,
where I'm
well,
going?
Okay, well, listen. Let's break it down so that it's really clear, okay? Nothing gets involved when we talk about the sociology. Nothing gets involved in the vacuum. Hip-hop could not have come out the way it did if it wasn't for the culture that hip-hop was in. People like Eddie Chiba, DJ Hollywood, and all those people, they got their sound from listening to WWRL, people like Hank Spann and Gary Bird and all of those other guys. Remember?
Exactly.
That was the DJ voice that you would hear on WWRL. So when DJ Hollywood saying, come on, get down, and all that stuff like that, that sound, they didn't get it from out of nowhere.
Right.
So I'm one of the people that's old enough to see the because for me it was just music. So whether it was Kool and the Gang, NT, or Ohio Players, or James Brown, or all that other stuff like that, that's the groove that hip hop was built on. You see, it didn't just come out of nowhere.
Right.
You see, so now when you're talking about PDJ Jones, here's the difference. Hip-hop, those DJs were DJs, but they weren't playing hip-hop music.
Exactly.
They were playing R&B music. Okay?
And some disco.
That's right. They were, because black people were dancing in clubs when as soon as clubs was out, black people was first doing their dancing. So I'm not really getting into who was first, but I am making a distinction that what was being done in hip-hop marked a specific type of expression that's unique within the urban black cultural experience. So there was PDJ Jones, there was Maboya, there was Flowers, there was King Charles. These were the guys that had those big sound systems that we were partying to. But they weren't playing the rap music. They were playing funk and R&B music, and they were playing club music, but they weren't playing hip-hop music because it wasn't there yet. The hip-hop
right.
music wasn't there yet. When I started hearing hip-hop music being played as hip-hop music, I was seeing DJ Divine in the parks. But DJs in the parks didn't start with hip-hop DJs because PDJ Jones and all those guys were doing the summer jams in the park.
Exactly.
So when people are arguing, they're arguing the wrong subject matter. Okay? So the DJs that were saying we were there first, yes, they were there first, but the culture that's being identified as hip-hop is basically what the ones in the Bronx came out and said, hey, man, we're doing this, because people were rapping on a microphone as soon as there was a microphone in the DJ,
mm-hmm.
because the equipment was there, so
mm-hmm.
there was somebody that was trying to impress some girl to get on a microphone and talk, all right, so it didn't just... People weren't just doing it in the Bronx. They were doing it in Brooklyn and Queens and Manhattan and whatever.
Remember Jocko?
Exactly. That's why I'm saying the fact that you know Jocko means that rapping didn't start. Jocko was rapping on a microphone too.
Exactly.
You know, Gary Bird was rapping on a microphone too. People were just doing it with a nice flow. But
Frankie
don't
Jocko
know history,
was rapping. What do you say? Listen.
That's right.
They were rapping.
Right.
They were rapping.
That's true.
Isaac
Absolutely.
Hayes was rapping. If you really
Isaac
want to
Hayes.
Talk about it.
That's
what,
and I'm saying when you start looking at it from that thing without seeing it as the egotistical, I need to be credited for inventing something, and you start
right.
seeing the social context of it, then you're realizing it was a flow. Because if you really listen to it, they were taking Martin Luther King and putting I Have a Dream speeches over beats. And even though you won't classify Martin Luther King as rap, his oration, his flow, is to me similar to listening to Rockin' doing Paid in Full.
Listen, we have a caller calling in from a 607 area code. Welcome to Hear No Evil. You're on live with the illustrious genius, engineer, DJ, producer, social conscious Eli Tubo.
Oh, wow. Well, that's a whole lot there. I just wanted to say I knew Mr. Eli Tubo before he was Mr. Famous Fellow. This is his youngest brother calling in just to say how proud I am of him. And I had no clue when he was DJing that he would make such an impact on the music industry. So I got to pat him on the back and say, well done. Well done. But I remember
okay.
him before he was famous.
Wow.
Wow,
well,
yeah.
Well, wow. So are you his real blood brother?
Yes,
actually,
I am. I'm
I
his
have
youngest brother. Yeah,
wow.
I'm a retired broadcast engineer, television broadcasting engineer, and it was interesting that my brother was working with music and sound, and he was very good at it. But I had no clue way back when he was a DJ that he would have the kind of impact that he has on the music industry, and most people don't really realize how much he has contributed to the music world. And I'm even hearing some things that I didn't even know about. But I'm enjoying your show, and I think it's outstanding what you all are doing, and I look forward to hearing everything else that's going to come out.
Well, thank you for calling in, dear brother. And what's your name?
My name is Zerano, Zerano Tubo.
Zerano Tubo. And you said broadcast. Was it TV or radio?
I was TV. I was television.
Oh,
yeah,
so
I was
mind-
also an engineer. I was a behind-the-scenes engineer. Something broke. We had to fix it. Camera goes down, 60 seconds to air, all that kind of stuff. It's real. It happened.
Was that in New York?
Yes, it was. Upstate New York.
Wow.
Upstate New York area.
Hey, hey, yeah. Don't be stealing my interview, man.
Well, I'm not going to steal his interview, but I can give all the real details on him. He wasn't always this great. No, he was good all the time. He started off being good. He was the lucky
Listen,
one.
I knew Eli was a gentleman in 1987 when we went to IHOP in Queens. You don't think I remember that, but you were such a gentleman, and I always said that there's been a lot of people that I would talk to musically and just to get in their heads. And as a female model, you know, at this time, you didn't know whether people had an agenda. But I must say, I knew Eli was such a gentleman before when he started becoming famous. I said, he's going to go places because he's just a nice person. Like you were. Now, you may have been a nut, and I didn't know it. But I
Oh, yeah,
well, that's because his mother got him in a headlock. His mother got him in a headlock.
It was page 15 on the keep your slob in, and you know, don't let your nut in the show. That's what it was.
But thank you for calling in. So I just see broadcasters runs in the family. I see.
It's kind of odd thing that he did. But you know what, Darlene, here's a point that I think is really interesting. With you being there, one thing I was able to see was that hip-hop wasn't always kind to women.
Mm.
Especially in the beginning, it was struggling so hard to make it, but a lot of it had to do with, you know, braggadocio, you know, being braggadocious and being powerful and breaking down doors and stuff like that. But I consider myself hip-hop, and my story is not everybody else's story, and I respect those people's – I respect their story because I'm fans of a lot of people in hip-hop. I mean, I would turn on the radio and I would listen to a track and say, oh, man, and whatever. It might be somebody that I knew or something I worked with, and I see it blow up and stuff like that. But the criminality is not the only aspect of hip hop, because a lot of people say if it ain't hardcore, it's not hip hop. But before it was that, that's what I was. So
now,
sometimes, go ahead.
Go ahead, because you're going somewhere that I was going to take you to. But go ahead.
Right. Sometimes, you know, we have to look at where we're at in regards to power. Okay? And I was talking to Ralph McDaniels about a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about how, you know, when somebody steps in and defines you or defines your culture, because he was saying, Eli, we invented this mixing and stuff like that, because Ralph was also a DJ at a club down in Queens, and we used to come and check each other out, because he was DJing at the Encore after I left Renaissance. And then he left Encore and went to do Video Music Box, and I left Renaissance and went to the Encore. But Ralph was telling me how she would listen to a hot record, but they can't put the record on radio because there's some corporate office that's telling them it ain't hot because we've studied, you, and we know the urban sound and this, so. He said, Eli, and I remember being a young producer and walking into a record label and playing a record, and this guy sitting on the other side of the desk and saying, you know what, it doesn't sound black enough. And, you know, so that thing.
Like, we only have one sound.
But that's crazy.
Like, who determines what's black?
But the person that was saying it wasn't black. That's the interesting thing.
Oh my God!
That means that somebody. That means that somebody outside of my social reality was defining what I was, and that's where power. That's where power comes in. Okay, because what happens is if you don't. That's why I'm saying the relationship between the dominant culture, because the dominant culture, the people in power, the ones that define standards of beauty and stuff like that, because believe it or not, if Africans had beat up the people that came and enslaved them, we'd all be walking around with afros right now as opposed to long, stringy hair. You know,
well, not all of us have big afro-type hair.
But I understand
what you're saying. So you're saying that, but this is happening with every form of music that – black people, because I don't want to say African, because, you know, not just African-Americans, you know, make people from the islands make contributed to music, but people of color, you know, we have really created the music that has controlled the masses in the world, but yet it's become so commercial that the love of it's just like once it starts becoming corporate controlled, something gets lost and you don't see the diversity. Because I remember one time that you would have like all of these different R&B groups and they all had a distinct sound. You knew the Temps from this group, from that group. You know, you knew Smokey Robinson from Blue Mad. You know Blue Magic. You knew Ted. But now, because hip-hop is all like one type of sound, like only one sound gets out. Like just like back in the modeling days, they would say, well, you know, we already have an exotic black model out. Or, you know, we already have one black model. You know, like do you have to only have one sound? You know, there's no distinction anymore, and everything is about gangster killing, misogyny, as if all black men do is kill, drink, get high, and have a whole lot of women. It's such a bad representation of what the culture has become, and it's really, really sad. And I blame the artists for not putting that.
No. We gotta step back because there's a much more.
Let me tell you something. If you are involved with music industry and don't know that the same people that control the distribution also own the alcohol companies, also own the marketing companies, also own the broadcasting companies, then you're crazy because we have people in all of those areas. Why aren't they doing something? How can you be in an advertising agency and promote a certain thing knowing that you live in that neighborhood? Probably you see that these things don't exist, but no one's saying enough is enough. We're not going to be represented like that.
It goes back to what we were saying about power. Okay, let's not make certain assumptions. Okay, one of the most important groups in hip hop, as far as I'm concerned, is the Sugar Hill Gang. And people are going to look at me like, say, what are you talking about? A lot of people are talking about artistry, flow, who spun on their head first, and stuff like that. But the reason why the Sugar Hill Gang is so important is because it proved to mainstream America that hip hop was economically viable. Because right now I go on the subway and I see kids spinning on their heads, and they're the most talented people that I've seen in the world. But it's not economically viable. It doesn't make any sense in terms of people investing in it. So when Sugar Hill Gang came out, there was a mad scramble for record companies to find somebody black that could do that rap thing on a record. And all of this money started getting poured into the black neighborhoods because someone said, because of the success of the Sugar Hill Gang. If Sugar Hill Gang was successful, it would have been like, oh, that's what they do, no big deal. All right.
Okay, we have another caller calling in from a 917 area code. Thank you for calling in. Caller, you're in the air with Eli Tubo.
Great Eli Tubo, I may add. What's up, my good man?
Wait a minute. I just got a little
wait. Hold on.
Hi, Eli. Happy Thanksgiving, honey.
Hi, how are you doing? I didn't think anybody would be eating turkey or stuff today. You know?
I actually did. I'm all stuffed up, but I miss you. You and your family, I wish them a beautiful Thanksgiving.
Thanks. Thanks for calling in.
Yeah.
Thanks for calling
in. I'm going to give you back your brother.
Yeah, hello?
This is another brother. How many brothers do you have, Eli?
He's got a lot, but not only does he have a lot of brothers, he has a lot of people who he's influenced. This man here that you're interviewing has influenced a myriad of people, me being one of them, and I would like to say I'm his best student. But the things that he's never going to tell you, everything that he has done, everything that he has accomplished, everything that he has inspired. So you probably should interview me so I can get on there and tell you and tell you, because he's too laid back. But
what's your name?
My name is Takota. And I'm one of his students.
But darling, remember we were talking about Paid in Full that night at the studio?
Right.
There was one other person in the studio. It was Eric, Ra, me, and Takota was there.
Wow.
He was there that night.
But I was there for many nights on many different occasions. But not only there, but through life. This guy has molded my life in ways that I can't even tell you this quick second. I would love to just be there with you so I could tell you the things that he really has done lifetime. And I'm not the only one that has this story, but he's an amazing guy.
Oh, thank you, man.
Amazing guy.
Thank you, man.
Like I said, you know, I live my life, and a lot of things that happened in my life has happened because of my tenure with him and guidance and tutelage of him. And he's just amazing. Like I said, he's never going to tell you these things, but one day I hope that I can. But he's done amazing. From the clubs and Justine's, from
Justine's. I mean, oh my God, he's the party at Justine's. Well, God, I'm getting my age away.
Yeah, no, don't worry. Your age is beautiful, especially if you party with him. But this man has changed the game. I remember listening to music. But then when I seen him do music, it just took me and my ears to a whole different level. I remember when he used to send Takaneta the mixtapes, and we would all wait to get this mixtape and play this mixtape. We huddle around and play this mixtape, and it just blew my mind. It just always blew my mind, and it just gave me. I just wanted to do it because he did it. And he's just amazing. He's just amazing. But you know, not just musically, but life wise. You know,
are you a DJ?
The people he's inspired, the people he's touched.
Are you a DJ? You a DJ?
I'm a student of Eli.
That's DJ or DJ Awesome Powers, man. That's his secret identity.
I'm a student of Eli. That's
radio.
What I am.
He's got his own internet radio show, which he just started doing a couple weeks ago.
Yeah. Okay. What's the name of it?
Well, there's two. One is Fonye Radio. The other one is Worldcast Radio. So Fonye.
Oh, I know about Fonye.
Oh, you know? Okay. So Sundays 1 to 5, I'm on, and on Worldcast Radio, it's Friday nights from 10 p.m. to 12 a.m.
And what's your format?
Yeah. What's that?
What's your format?
It's hip hop and R&B.
Okay.
But it's in a whole different. Well, Eli can tell you that it's a whole different way of doing things. Matter of fact, the show, I call it The Experience. But again, whatever I'm doing, it's a direct from him.
The
it
whole
comes directly,
family
directly
are broadcasters. Wow.
Yeah.
It seems like every time you interview somebody, they try to take over my show. I don't know what this is.
I tell you, boss, clearly, it must be the Tubo blood.
We don't want to take over the show.
I want to thank you for calling in. We're going to take a pause for the cause, and we will be right back.
Fantastic. Thanks for having me.
to take you back there to the 1970s with some Trami with Donna Summers. But listen, if you guys haven't picked up The Harlem Poet, which is my seventh book, make sure you go to futurenetworkproductions.com, or you can always Google Darlene Lewis for The Harlem Poet. It is my seventh attempt at being an author. It contains poems and songs that I have written since I was age 16 up until about 5 months ago, and it also includes pictures of the old Harlem. Some of the greatest times in my life was growing up in Harlem, New York City. So once again, we're back here with Eli. We have about 33 minutes, so if you guys want to talk to Eli, you better call in 347-989-0761. And you're back on, Eli.
Wow. Okay. You know what? Give me a chance to think before you, before the last segment, when you were talking about the state of hip-hop today, there's a couple of things that I want to say that I think is really important.
Okay.
I am not just into music and hip-hop, but I'm also a fan of hip-hop, too, okay? And I realize that the fact that it has become what it is, it's brilliant. There's a lot of brilliant people that were involved in it. And so whether I would listen to a Busta track or Craig Mack or stuff like that, there was stuff that I just loved.
Mm-hmm.
This stuff was done, if you remember, back in the 70s and the 80s and even the 90s, there used to be music programs in the school in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And this has to go with policies affect music. When they cut those social programs in which there weren't any music programs in the school, a lot of people that were doing music before had learned the basics of music in those high school and junior high school programs. When they cut the music programs, then a lot of them didn't have the music background. But with all of that, with a lot of the kids growing up making the music, they still were able to make things through sampling and stuff, even without having a serious music background. Okay, so when you were talking about how you met me before and stuff like that, and I was a respectful man and stuff like that, and, you know, I've heard people say, you know, when they were around me, they felt safe and stuff like that, because that's the type of man that I am. So anything that goes in terms of disrespecting people, disrespecting women, disrespecting children, men, whatever, I have a problem with that. That's not where I'm at, okay? That's not what I do. So the subject matter of hip-hop is, how can I put it? Let me put it this way. Imagine going to a movie about zombies, okay? You go to this movie, and it's a fantastic movie about zombies, and it becomes a hit. So somebody says, oh, my God, we got to make another movie. So you make all these movies about zombies, and then you forget how to make music, how to make movies about other subject matters.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's the same thing with us. We are creators. That's what we do. But when someone starts defining your creativity and you get out of the habit of being a creator, you forget how to create and you start emulating certain things. So that R&B music, someone says, you know what, if it's not about sex, sex sells. So now all the R&B songs have the same subject matter. All the women are talking about intense emotional experiences, and they think that that's good. You know, my man left me, my this, that. So every R&B song, a woman is singing about how the man left her, this or that.
Mm-hmm.
The hip-hop is sort of the same thing. It's like going to the movies and forgetting that every movie doesn't have to be about zombies. Every movie doesn't have to be about killing. Everything doesn't have to be about pain, because what people are forgetting is that there's a direct relationship between what you create and what you live.
Mm.
Okay? So people are starting to legitimize that they have the right to create anything without realizing the result that it's going to have on the conditions they will live. If you don't understand what I'm talking about, you will put yourself into a cycle in which you will forget after a while, or you won't be able to tell the difference between what you imagine and what you're living, because they're both happening at the same time. So we've been involved with hip-hop long enough to say, look at what happens when someone else says it's got to be hardcore. It's got to be about this aspect of your experience, and if it's not that, we're not going to validate it. to all the other things about hip-hop that were different expressions were not validated by record labels. And it's the same as any religion. You know, if a guy comes in and says this is the right way to do something, and then all of a sudden people forget what he's talking about, and then you have these holy wars killing people in the name of Christ. It's the same thing.
Mm.
You know, we're not involved in anything different. It's just a certain pattern that we have to start recognizing where someone in power is starting to say, this is what I decide is important, and because you need the money, because you need to eat every day, you'll say, okay, you don't want this song, okay, you take that song. Okay, you don't like this tune, you're going to take that tune. Because if we had our own money, then we would put out what we want. And in a way, that's kind of nice about what's happening with the internet, in that it doesn't go through the funnel of a record label telling you, this is good, this is not good, this is good. But what happens is we kind of lost, you know, getting back to your point, we kind of lost the fact that, you know what, we can use our creativity to imagine wonderful and beautiful things for ourselves and for our community. But instead, we've gotten to this habit of thinking that it has to be about misogyny, that it has to be about disrespect. And we're losing our ability to create because we've forgotten how to reach in and bring out something else. So then hip-hop becomes synonymous with what we're seeing.
But now, yeah, because I was starting to think that there must be something wrong when everyone is bragging about the material stuff that they have. Like, when you're a certain age and live a certain status, you no longer have to talk about what you have or what you do or, you know, who you're screwing. Like, when you get a certain age, like, why is that still the theme of your music? So they have forgotten. I don't think that they've forgotten. I think that they're just lazy.
Record
companies are telling them, listen, we need to feed to the mindset of the poor person because we want them to think that this is what's important. Because there are songs out there, but they just don't get played.
I mean, true, but here's the thing that we can't forget. The purpose of the music industry, the record companies, were not, their main purpose is not to allow you to express what you think is relevant to yourself. It's not for you to express who you are as a human being. That's not what the record companies are there for, because if that's the case, you might as well just go in the shower and sing whatever song that you want, and that allows for that flow to happen. Once you go into agreement with somebody that has a different agenda, and that agenda is to make money, the bottom line is to make money. So it is not their responsibility to be socially conscious. That is not what they are there for. So we're putting these two things together, saying, why aren't the record companies making socially conscious records and stuff like that? They don't care. They basically care about the stockholders and their checkbook at the end of the day. Okay? Mm-hmm. So that's what people stand for. We think that we want to do things that are beneficial for our community. But if they could come up with something that could make records, like that, they do it. So we're putting two things together that don't match. It's nice when you can do it together, where Michael Jackson can make a song that says, you know, heal the world, make it a better place, and stuff like that. That's what I really think music should be used for. But there are other people that they don't care about that.
Mm-hmm.
They don't care about that. And here's the thing that we don't realize, okay? But our relationship, especially the urban community, we don't understand our relationship to music in terms of its social implications, its spiritual implications, okay, in terms of how it heals us, okay? When we have an idea in our head, it has to come out or we're not healthy. We have to flow in a certain way. Okay, that's just who we are, that's just what we do. And music is one of the ways in which we become healthy by allowing ourselves to flow. When someone else defines that, it affects our psyche, it affects our spirituality, it affects our health, it affects everything. We are in a society that commercializes everything. So as soon as a song comes out, we're sitting there judging whether it's good or whether it's not. And that's not really the prime thing. The prime thing is you should be able to express your creative ideas in order to be a healthy human being. So now every time a song comes out, every time, you know, a rap comes out, everybody's talking about it's whack, it's this, it's what that. And that's like a child buying you a tie for your birthday, a two-year-old tie, and then you look at the tie, instead of saying thank you for the gift or your happy child gave it to you, you're looking at it and saying, I don't like this tie. We wouldn't do that to a child, but we do it to ourselves with the music. Because we're always judging whether it's good or whether it's bad. And that's the difference between being an engineer and a producer. When somebody comes into the studio and they have an idea, I don't sit there in the back of my mind and say, this sucks, or this isn't good. I basically help them bring out what's inside of them, and I try to make it the best that it possibly can be. And that's why I don't categorize hip-hop into R&B, into gospel, into stuff. All that stuff, it makes no sense whatsoever. We're killing ourselves with that.
So now, in regards to the theme of tonight's topic, the most embarrassing thing that has ever happened to you in the music industry or in the studio or on the road.
Is that the show that I'm on?
every week we have various questions that we poll, and whoever raises the most votes, their question gets to be asked. So that is the topic question of the night. The most embarrassing thing or the most thankful thing that you are thankful for on Thanksgiving Day.
Okay, well, I'll give you the most, I won't say the most embarrassing thing, but I think that the thing that's embarrassing for, say, an engineer or producer is to be working on a project for a label, and then all of a sudden, you're not called anymore, and then you hear the record on the radio, and you realize, oh shucks, they did it without me. they fired me, and I didn't even know I was fired. You know, that hasn't happened. That hasn't happened that much. But you know, that is the thing in terms of music business. You gotta be on your, you gotta compete. You gotta be on your toes and stuff like that. And sometimes it's your fault. Sometimes it's not. But you know, to hear something that you think stinks, you know, that's not that good, and all of a sudden it blows up, and you go like, wow, that's an eye-opening experience, you know. So you learn to respect everything and see things through a different eye. You learn to respect people's creativity.
Let me ask you something. In regards to engineering, okay, when you're in the studio, you have to fill out a log form, right? The record companies and the producers have to fill out a form. So when a record comes out and the engineer's name is not on the record, is there a certain law that says that the engineer has to be listed on the record?
No. That's a great question, and that's a great point. We always look at the credits, and we assume that the credits are right. And there's a lot of times that the credits are not right, okay? It all depends on how proficient the production company is and proficient the record company is, okay? Because let's just say you have somebody that leaves your name off or somebody that doesn't want to put your name on, and that has happened, you know, that will happen. You know, sometimes there's a record that was done and they didn't like the mix, and then they called me in the mix, the record, but at the end of the day, they didn't want to go back in and change the credits because the album was already printed out, so my name got left off. You know, that's just what happens.
So are you at liberty to mention the songs that we may hear that you remix? This is your opportunity to let your fans know songs they were.
Well, at this particular point, I'm really fortunate.
It was 20 years ago. I want to know.
What song that was done?
Did that happen to you ever?
It happens a couple of times. It happens a couple of times. I mean, I think one song that I can remember.
done so much.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. But for the most part, after the Eric B., Rakim, Run DMC, and stuff like that, people wanted my name on their records. It depends on when you get hot and stuff like that. There's a lot of things about the business that I do want to say this one thing too. When hip hop really started becoming prominent, what a lot of people don't realize is that the image of hip hop started to affect the music business as well. So mm-hmm. as opposed to people emulating good business practices, they started getting their business models from criminals and stuff like that. So there's a difference between you being able to schedule a recording session 2 weeks in advance and stuff like that, or somebody calling you up at the last second and saying, hey, you got to be there now. Or mm-hmm. somebody who pays you at the end of the session, and then all of a sudden you got people all of a sudden that are paying you 2 months, 3 months, 4 months behind. That's the type of stuff that started happening when people
really?
Had to walk up to record labels, with guns drawn and say, where's my money and stuff like that. The negative aspects of the hip-hop culture started affecting the music business in a certain way, where certain people started saying, you know what, I'm not feeling this. Why is it that I have to be an independent small businessman and you have a multi-million dollar company and I got to wait 3 months or 4 months to get paid, where at the end of me advancing them my services and my fees and stuff like that, I don't get a percentage of the product. What kind of deal is that? And
wow.
a lot of the engineers started saying, you know what, I'd rather deal with independent clients that are going to pay me and pay me right away than have to wait for, major label clients. And a lot of the production companies that people admire so much, you would think that because they were young and they were black and they understood poverty and where we came from, that they would be forthright in paying people as soon as possible. But they didn't. Some producers were really good at paying people. Some people really sucked at paying people.
And would it be because they thought that they could just get over, or were they just, like you said, just criminals and just?
I don't want to say because they were criminals, because there's a lot of people that, and I'm gonna say this in a certain way. The fact that we survived, a lot of times we survived because of criminality. And I'm not endorsing criminality, but a lot of times you couldn't go to a bank and get an unsecured loan to do a record. You would either have your parents that basically was working for the city, and they would give you an allowance, or they would give you money, or you'd have a little job, or somebody in the neighborhood like Bumpy wanted to flip that money and would give somebody a couple of G's and stuff like that. This is all part of our culture.
Right.
Part of the black culture. And so criminality had a real close tie with hip-hop, because you could go to somebody and they would invest, in hip-hop. But what makes it bad, that's how a lot of us survive. Some of us survive through education. Some of us survive through having bars and businesses. Some of us survive through criminality. That's part of our history altogether,
right?
But and I'm just speaking real, but the point is, there are people that are either, for whatever reason, they'll pay you. They're mm-hmm. good business people, and then there are other people that didn't pay people. And I started hearing a lot of my friends saying, you know what, this guy, he's got a lot of money, he's this or that, but for some reason he doesn't pay right away. And that's one of the realities of the music business, that people started getting really turned off.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, so with the onset of online production, and where a lot of times people are producing, easier from their home, from their computer,
mm-hmm.
How does that affect you as an engineer with the new technology?
Well, it goes back to what we were talking about at the very beginning. The very beginning was saying that you have to
look, you have to have a plan, and you have to know exactly where you're going, what you want to do, and you can't get stuck in something that was successful back then. So there's a whole lot of things that are changing. You know, there's Pro Tools and stuff like that. So sometimes there's something called mixing in the box, where somebody emails you their files, and you sit there and you mix the record and you send it back to them. Sometimes some people still are in the transition of going to a big studio and mixing there. Sometimes people are learning to mix in headphones. Sometimes people are learning to mix with small monitors. Some people are learning the relationship between analog, digital conversion, and what's the best way to get certain things done. So you have to stay on top of the technology. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, the sad part about it is that most of the money that was coming into the professional music community was coming through record label recording budgets. That's how they were paying the musicians, the artists, the singers, the engineers, the producers, the studios. Okay? That mm-hmm. money was coming in that way. Now, when the record companies decided that they weren't going to give out recording budgets anymore, it left a lot of responsibility on the artist to produce the record, write the song, produce the video, put it up on the internet, see if it's happening, and, you know, stuff like that. So what it did was it cut the working class music individual professional so that you have a lot of music industry hobbyists now, people that are doing it part-time or people that are taking their own personal funds and trying to do that. So the whole professional music community that was there is almost being what has been wiped out for the most part. It's been wiped out. So there were people that were living as session background singers, where you needed a background singer to come in or do something, and this girl might have four or five sessions a week. Those days seem to be gone now. What about somebody that actually would be a song that was being done, and you needed somebody to come in and add a beat on it or do some scratching to make it hot? Those days seem to be gone now, which kind of leads into that video that you saw this week, right?
The one Tyrone Brunson Fresh. Yeah, you were involved with that project as well.
Say what?
I saw that. Yeah, that was amazing. So let's talk about that video.
Yeah, I mean, it was.
Did you
play
a major part in that song?
Well, I did the scratching on it.
But why is Ice-T the one in the video?
Because I was in New York. I got a call from CBS Records, and they said that Tyrone Brunson had come out with the Smurf, and it was a hot record, so they were coming out with the second record, and he called me and said, Eli, I got this record that's hot, but it has no vocals on it. I can't release a record with no vocals. He said, so at that time, Herbie Hancock was hot with that record that was the scratching. He said, well, can you come down? Can you do some scratching or whatever? So I said, okay. So I came down to the studio. I put the James Brown on, and it was the diggy-diggy one, diggy-two. I did the scratching on and stuff like that. All right? Tyrone Brunson is in California. So I didn't find out until maybe 2 years ago, 3 years ago. I'm surfing on the internet looking at, you know, doing some research on myself, trying to figure out how many gold and platinum records I have and stuff like that. And I see that there's a video on Tyrone Brunson. And I'm just like, oh, did you get a video on that? Oh, okay. And I punch the thing in, and I look, and that's when I saw the video. So what they did was they did it in California. That's how it happened.
Wow. And so all of these years, they were pushing that video, and you didn't know it.
Yeah. I mean, because what happened, as an engineer, projects come in and projects go, and sometimes I forget some stuff I did. Like, I forgot that I had mixed that record, The Roof Is On Fire. I forgot
the
that
roof.
I had done that.
That was hot.
I forgot that. So a lot of times what happened was that I started putting my discography together, and I was saying, well, how many gold platinum records that have my name and credits on it? That I started Googling myself. I was like, oh, that's why I did that. Oh, that got to do. Oh, that's why I did that. And I'm sort of like compiling all that stuff and putting myself back out there again, you know.
Wow. Well, you know, we have 9 minutes left, and I see we have another caller that has called in from a 917 area code. Briefly, say hello to Eli Tubo, caller.
How you doing, Eli?
Hey, how you doing? It's a pleasure to talk to you.
One love, one love, one love.
Who's this? Who's this?
This is Jalil from Houdini.
Get out of here.
What's up, family?
Get in me, man. See, this is somebody you need to interview.
Well, I've been trying to interview, you know, I love him. You know, I've always loved him since, you know, he's such a great writer. And I've been trying to get this guy to call in this radio show. For how long, Ja? It took Eli Tubal.
Get out of here. Matter of fact, hold on. Have you talked to Larry? Have you talked to Larry Lason recently?
Unfortunately, Larry had like a double stroke 2 years ago.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, he's unable to speak. I've seen him several times, though. Yeah.
Oh, so,
wait,
right.
What,
so
Larry? Larry Smith?
Yes,
yeah.
No.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. Because back then, Larry was, and here's what's funny. When Larry was doing Houdini and all that stuff like that, he also was the bass player for Curtis Blow.
That's right.
When Curtis Blow was going out on the road. And Davey DMX was the DJ.
Yeah.
And the guitar player.
And, like, Davey D was the DJ, the guitar player. And Run was the son of Curtis Blow.
Right.
And that's when Houdini was hot and everything like that. And it was all in the same clique, man. It was good to see you, man. I mean, good to hear from you.
Yes. Well, it took a little bit after that for us to get the heat, you know, but that's his history, yes.
Yeah. But that was Rush Town Management and all back then where we were all building that stuff together. You know, and the thing is that you gotta give each other credit for what we did, because sometimes we're in the midst of it and we don't see the bigger picture in terms
right.
of what we actually did, and this is a great opportunity to say, you know, your work and your work ethic and what you've done, you know, you're iconic, and a lot of people don't talk about Houdini, but Houdini was important because there were certain groups like Curtis Blow. Curtis Blow was important because Curtis Blow was appealable to the mainstream America. Okay,
yes.
Curtis Blow could do a talk show and people could look at him and not be scared.
Yes.
You see, Houdini was an articulate rap group that was still in the streets but still could be taken to other formats that could
expand
the base.
But they were fun. Let's not forget that part, okay?
They were fun.
Well,
actually, there was one of them. That I didn't know one. If he didn't have his hat on, I didn't know who he was.
Ecstasy, he had a twin brother. Yeah, but Ja was sexy, though. Remember how Ja used to be up there? You know, like, everybody loved Houdini.
See, but I don't know nothing about
that.
I didn't know nothing about that. I'm going to give him his props in terms of being
Listen,
Houdini.
Yeah.
I ain't going to stand on the line, and say he was sexy. That's not, you know, I'm not going
to. See, a lot
there.
Of people don't understand the importance that these guys were rapping, but they were like singers. They were like rock stars. You know
yeah,
what I'm saying?
Yeah, the one love, all that stuff,
yeah,
man.
They were singing. Come on, they were rapping and singing, and they had suits.
Can you hear me? Can you understand this? In the beginning of hip-hop, cats dressed.
True.
We lose sight and we lose focus on when the breakdance era come in and everybody's just talking about all Adidas. And the sweatwear, we did a lot of that. But go and look back at the DJ Hollywood when he was 18 coming through. He was dressed to impress for the young ladies. Go look at the Cold Crush brothers back in the 79. They were doing shows with suits on.
So
dressing up has always really been a part of hip hop. It just had got lost for a minute when one of them came, well, L came in with it, made it, like, youthful, and then it got a little ruggy. And that was cool, too, because that still was a part of hip-hop. But somehow the media focused more in on us not looking as sharp, so we had to stay sharp so they could get a whiff of it, you know?
I mean, darling, you could do a real you could do a real show on changes and transitions and stuff in hip-hop, because you can't, I mean, I remember sometimes you ask a question like, do the young hip-hop people owe anything to, you know, to the old school and stuff like
right,
that?
Right, I had a show on
right,
that.
Right,
and a lot of people,
be honest, I don't expect
a lot of
anybody
people
to give me
didn't
want to
give them their props, and I think
yeah,
that's
listen,
a have a
I think giving somebody their props is different than giving somebody a check. You know, I don't expect nobody to give me a check as a result of what I did. And I'm not sitting back there with my nose poked out going, how come nobody is sending me a check my way, because I was the one that did, paid in full and moved. That's ridiculous. If I don't keep myself current, I become irrelevant. Mm-hmm. But at the same
yeah.
token, I guess to answer the question, what are we calling props, when I do walk into a room, I must admit that people do look at me with a certain type of awe because of the iconic records that I have done. And I'm just learning to get comfortable with that, to tell you the truth. Because, you know, I'm this is the first interview. Actually, darling, this is the first interview, radio interview, that I've really done.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. Because, I mean, I do have a lot to say now. But back
mm-hmm.
in the day, we were too busy. Houdini, he was too busy trying to create and make his thing happen, you know. I mean, and, you know, I have to say that they are artists, but it was a lot of work. It was a lot of hard work to do what we were doing. It was a tremendous amount of hard work. I didn't have time to go to the shows. I didn't have time to go to parties. I didn't have time, you know. So I was learning new technologies. I mean, I was
that's different, right?
Yeah, I
right.
was getting
I was
that,
right.
I was
you was
next,
a producer.
Yeah, I was getting that next session. You know, I was trying to get that $1 million hit so I could maybe sit back and, you know, row a boat and look at you guys on shore and wave or something like that. So it was
This has really been a great Thanksgiving night. We have like less than 2 minutes left on the air, but I would like to say thank you to both of you for calling into the show. Hear No Evil, we're on every Thursday at 6:30. But I gave it a special extra hour just for you, Eli, and to have Ja call in. Well, that's amazing. I have to have him call back in again in a couple of weeks. I have to make that arrangement because he's such an incredible person. I'm trying to get him to do a book because he's had a tremendous
That book is
career.
Coming.
Yeah.
I hope so. But
If you don't tell him the story, somebody will fill in the blanks and tell it for
exactly.
you and it won't be right.
Exactly.
Yes,
and,
you gotta tell it.
As I always say, when you're divine, no one can define you and no one can consign you. And on that note, I want to thank you both for calling in. Thank you so much, listeners out there that are online, that called in from Albany, Jersey, San Diego, and Atlanta, all of you that tried to talk to Eli. He's such a busy person, but you can find Jalil and Eli on Facebook and tune in every Thursday at 6:30. Make sure you guys go to futurenetworkproductions.com to get my books, to learn about my TV show, and to listen to former broadcasts with some of the greatest artists that ever graced the music industry. I'm Darlene Lewis, your show's host and producer, and until next week, be blessed.
One love.
Thank you, guys.
Peace. Thank you, Darlene. Eli.
Yeah, my man. You got to hook up.
Yes. You got a pen or something with you now?
Yeah, actually, I do. Yeah?
Okay, I'm 916-426-4750.
826-4750.
Perfect.
Right, 826-4750. And I'm 845-665-2225.
Well, when you hit me up, I'm going to have you with me. I'm happy like that, okay?
Yes. I'm on Facebook, right?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
One love, family.
Hey,
I got the number.